Welcome to the Organic Gardener Podcast. I'm your host, Jackie Marie Beyer. Let's get growing.
Welcome to the show today, listeners. I am so excited to introduce someone I met down when I went to the farmer's market in Missoula, and we've been trying to connect, and hopefully our sound is going to work today. So sorry about that, and I'm talking to my podcasting buddies trying to fix that. So hopefully David and Mai's interview is going to go good today. And here I'm shouting, so I hope that's not going to be me be too loud, but we'll do our best. So anyway, David was one of the most interesting people I talked to down there that day. And he is one of the, is it the board member? Well, welcome to the show, David.
Yes, thank you.
Now, are you a board member or director for the Arley Farmers Market?
Just a board member. It's a triumvirate. There's three of us. I'm just one of three of equals.
And so he has just tons of information to share with us, not only about growing food, but also some good tips about starting your own farmer's market and some of the challenges there and some of the pluses and some of the things that are going well. So I think we're all going to learn a lot today. David, yeah. Welcome to the show. Go ahead and tell us a little bit about yourself.
Well, I've lived in Western Montana all my life. I've traveled, but I just kept coming back here. And I'm now 60, and I've learned a few things in those 60 years. Still have a lot more to learn, I'm sure.
Okay. So do you want to tell us, just to start off, like, what does organic gardening or earth-friendly gardening mean to you?
Well, I appreciate that your question said organic gardening slash earth-friendly, because as I have seen the organic gardening movement mature, I'm really glad to see it embrace more research, more discovery, and make it something that's actually far more valuable. I remember back in 1970 when I was a teenager and still just exploring and discovering the organic method versus the chemical method, that there were a lot of ideas that have since been discarded, fortunately, we learned. And so for me, it's a continuous process. We are going to learn more things. We've learned much more about beneficials, insects, for example, and we're exploring interesting features about microorganisms and their interactions. There's just a whole range of things that are probably going to be coming soon that are going to revolutionize agriculture, and there's more crossover. Traditional agriculture, as we want to call it, I should say chemical. Traditional really is organic, but chemical agriculture is adopting some of these things that were first tried out with organic farmers. So in that respect, I find it a very fascinating time to be gardening.
Do you want to go any deeper and tell us some of the things that you're seeing, the, you know, I guess if we're not going to call it traditional, but the more, you know, big producers, the chemical people using?
Well, I think that there have been some realities. Right now we have an easing of the energy issue, but that was a fear, is if there's definitely sometime going to be a limit to fossil fuels. And a lot of people don't realize that that's a major source of the nitrogen. The nitrogen that's used in standard agriculture comes from various fossil fuels, and it's what's pumped up production throughout the world. The entire food industry is so dependent on that. Well, now we're learning more about other ways to do things. We've already explored different ways of breeding plants that can maybe tolerate less fertility. Perhaps we can get into a better understanding of soil and maybe have microbes that would naturally be able to provide some of the fertilizing. Yeah, it's going in many directions, and some ideas no doubt look promising that will be discarded later on. Other ideas, we can't even imagine what they are, but they'll be coming along, and we'll be seeing some major changes in how we grow the food that a very large population on this planet needs every single day.
Cool. Oh, so many valuable things that you said there, and things that I think are so important. Like when people are like, you know, they just kind of go back on the you know, standard, well, this is what we're doing and this works and alternatives are too expensive and there's not enough success. And I just think that's so key that we're not going to get to that success without failure, without trying. You know, how many times did Thomas Alva Edison build a light bulb and it didn't work? You know,
yes.
People that are successful, it's from trying and trying and not succeeding. And it's just like, I think over and over.
Very true.
Why we need blocks in kindergarten, because kids need to see what happens when the blocks fall down and how to do it again until it does build. I mean, it just starts all there from, you know, seeing what doesn't work is going to be what helps you see what does work. And gardening is such a great example of that, because I think all of us have that feeling like as soon as you see something not working, you're already thinking, well, this is what I'm going to do different next year. So thank you, David. I think that's awesome.
So
one of the best answers to that question I've heard. So do you want to tell us, so who or what inspired you to start using organic techniques back in the 70s then? Is that when it was?
I met a very wonderful woman in my church. She's gone now. I didn't know what was her name. And she was a subscriber to the Rodale publications, Prevention and Organic Gardening. And so she brought older issues, and I was just hooked. I just thought this was wonderful, and I was interested in growing things. I didn't have much experience. My mother had pretty much given up gardening. She was working three jobs, and she was just too tired, and so I kind of was learning, and I was so grateful to get this information. It was basically a system. It was a structure. And it had all these experiences from other people trying so many new and different things, and I just loved it. So that's what got me into it, was the Rodale publications from a friend, starting in 1970.
Awesome. Well, and I don't know if you've listened to my show, but I talk about Rodales a lot because they are totally my inspiration, and I have loved them.
Mm-hmm.
Now, I do have to mention, listeners, and I've been wanting to say this, so I'm just going to throw it in there now, that I would not have found the Flower Farmer book that I talk about a lot if I did not get an email from Chelsea Green Publishing, who is also another amazing publisher. So if you love Rodales, you might also want to check out Chelsea Green Publishing out of Vermont. One of these days, okay, I'm going to do an episode about them. But definitely, I am a huge Rodales fan. And now they've started this new thing. Instead of organic gardening, it's organic life. And I think that's so interesting, because somebody was asking me about my, you know, target market, like who are my listeners? And I, you know, what are they interested in? And all I can think is gardening's a lifestyle. It's not just about organic gardening, but it's about a lifestyle. And then I was thinking that Rodales now has the Organic Life magazine, which I'm very excited to start subscribing to. And anyway, back to you, David. So is that how you learned how to garden organically, from reading that magazine? Or
yes, I started trying the techniques. I disciplined myself not to just run to the nearest can of chemicals, which was the norm for back then. It's like, oh, you have weeds, well, go find something to dump on the soil. If you have this or that, you go find something in a can. And it wasn't questioned. It was considered the way to do things. And pretty much all agriculture and home gardening had completely gone over to using cans of stuff like DDT and cans of various fertilizers that had a detrimental effect on the overall soil health, turned it into concrete. But here was this alternative that was saying, well, okay, these innovations are interesting, but we really need to develop different ways, more natural ways, more sustainable ways. And as I say, it was and is a theory in progress, because some recommendations back then we wouldn't even think of doing now. And those things have come along all the time.
Okay, so let's talk about your garden this year. Tell us about something that grew well this year, which when I saw you at the market, you had some amazing things there.
Yeah, well, the pepper plants and a lot of the potted things I had been doing for years. I had to do a lot less for several years because of caring for my aging parents. They're now gone. And so I was able to come back into the market. And there's a wonderful woman at the market that she used to be on the board of the Missoula Farmers Market. And She wasn't anymore, but she still was one of the godmothers. She was there and always checking and asking, and we shared a lot of ideas. So I asked her, I said, well, I'm getting back in now that my parents are gone. I'm able to do more again. What does the market need? And she said, tomatoes. At that time, there was like not one single tomato purveyor in the railroad market. The one purveyor had moved to the market down along the river. So tomatoes, and then she also said, do something about the prices. So I thought, okay, that's an interesting order. I'd never really done tomatoes other than my own personal use. So I did the research and I played around and I had a lot of fun growing tomatoes. And like I say, you learn from your mistakes. So I had a whopper of a mistake this year. I think that's one of the questions, what didn't do well. Well, unfortunately, it's tomatoes. I had a spectacular, unrelenting aphid problem, and I basically pulled my crop out. And that was quite a blow to me personally. I've had to accommodate that. But once again, embrace your disasters. Learn from them. Love your mistakes. Because now I'm thinking of doing other things. I will know now how to handle the aphids in a timely and organic fashion. I did try to handle them organically. It's just that they were overwhelming. And there was really no chemical alternative, I might add. So people say, oh, you should have tried chemicals. No, there really wasn't. But the bottom line is that next year I will have tomatoes. And next year I will have other things, too. I've learned to branch out and to start planning always for the following year.
Okay, are you going to... Okay, well, quickly, just I want to tell people, if you don't know, in Missoula, there's two markets on Saturday morning, and one's by the railroad tracks and the other's down by the river, is just what he meant by the railroad market. And then, are you going to tell us what your solution to the aphid problem was?
Like, well, it was the fact that we had an unusual spring.
We sure did, didn't we?
It was a spring like I hadn't seen in 40 years. It was perhaps not so spectacular to urban people, but as a gardener, somebody who pays attention to the weather from dawn to dusk and through the night, too, it was so windy at Arleigh, where I grow. And so April and May, very little rainfall, lots of wind, very low humidity. This was unprecedented. And I'm only theorizing, I'm doing more research, but somehow this meant that as much as I would use the soap sprays, the natural sprays to eliminate the aphids, which, by the way, even traditional, or I shouldn't say traditional, but the chemical growers would recommend using these different things that are considered organic, I would knock out the population, but these alates, the winged females, would come flocking back in from somewhere. And it was just unrelenting. I did let the ball drop a few times because in 40 years, I never had really seen tomatoes infested with aphids. So I sure learned this year that they can be, and if there's certain weather conditions, one has to be better prepared. So what's my preparation for next year? Well, I realize that maybe I won't see these conditions again for 40 years. Well, by that time, I'll be 100 years old, so I may not be growing tomatoes. But I will be aware of them, and I can immediately quickly order screening for the entrances to the hoop houses so that once I eliminate the initial infestation of aphids, I won't have the alates, the winged females, coming back in to reinfest the greenhouse. Again, it's something that many people, but they've never seen such a bad aphid year, and I felt I wasn't alone. I just felt that I had a really particularly bad problem in my area that just overwhelmed.
Okay, cool. I think listeners are going to like that part a lot. And, you know, I met some other people at the market and said, where did you get these tomatoes and how do you have tomatoes already? And they said they got them from you. So couldn't have been all that bad. Okay.
No, my plants were fine. I should say that the plants I grew, I did grow approaching 1,000 plants for others. And initially, you know, they were fine, but it was my crop that I then transplanted into my greenhouses that the great aphid disaster occurred. So in that respect, I still make money off the tomatoes. I got my money back. That's always a nice thing. But for growing my own, because I grew some varieties that only I grow, nobody else is interested. One of them is a seedless tomato. And there were many people at the market depending on my crop of seedless tomatoes because of medical issues. They can't eat seedy things. So I had to disappoint them. I felt really bad about that one. So that's why I'm doubling up and making sure that next year I can avoid this and try to anticipate other problems in a more proactive way.
Now, what? So what do you start? Did she tell me you start the tomatoes like in December in your greenhouse?
I start them actually in my house in December. We have to go back to that principle that wonderful woman, Natalie Lyons, she said, grow tomatoes and then do something about the price. So I thought every inch of the way, how can I do this the most economically? Well, obviously in December, my house is already heated. I like to be freezing to death in my own house, obviously. So tomato plants, when they start, they don't need much space. And so I just use my house to start the plants. It's already heated, and I'm not then also heating the greenhouse, the expense, unnecessary use of fuels. So all along, trying to be as efficient as possible determines how I grow things. And then also I just feel it's more in keeping with the entire organic spirit is be as easy on resources as possible and yet grow things well and grow them as efficiently as one can. So my house is already heated. The plants don't take much room initially. It's only when they get bigger, then I start incrementally putting them in places where I have to start heating. So incrementally, I increase the carbon footprint, if you want to call it, but not right away. I don't like just heating up a huge greenhouse in the dead of winter for a few plants. That's not sensible, and it's certainly not economical.
Okay. But didn't you say there's like 1,000 of these plants? Like even 1,000 seedlings seems like that would take up part of a room.
Indeed, it does. So I have, when I start them and I sprout them, they're in trays. There's 200 seedlings in a tray that's 1 foot by 2 foot. So actually, 10 square feet would accommodate 1,000 seedlings. But of course, they're very tiny. They grow only a week or two, actually probably 2 weeks in that size container. Then they have to be moved to slightly larger. Well, then that's 72 plants to a tray, or basically 36 plants to 1 square foot. Okay, now we're talking enough square footage to where I do have to start firing up what I call my plant house. And it's not very big. It's only 12 by 16, but it has double layers shelving with grow lights. And that way I can concentrate in a small building a very large number of plants again, well, a full 1,000. After that, in another month or two, then I do have to start expanding outside and start getting greenhouses heated and go to that expense. But by then we're talking February, March. The temperature's starting to ease. There's much more light coming from the sun, which provides a lot of the heat. And from then on, it just gets better and better every week.
Okay. So I'm just curious, because I kind of wondered when you're growing things in December, if there is enough light. So do you use those grow lights like right from the start? And is that part of how you're able to? Because I know like I've tried to grow basil plants in December because that's always when I'm like, oh, yeah, I need my basil plant, like need a fresh one or something. And it's never been successful. So is that like part of how you're getting them to grow?
It's absolutely crucial. And the reason is that there's so little light at our latitude. We're, let's say, the 47th parallel runs right through between Arlene and Missoula, so that gives us an idea of our northerly location. Where you're at, you're pushing the 49th parallel, so we're quite far north. And the trouble is that there's very little light. The sun angle's so low, and the sun is up for so few hours, it's just not sufficient. So using the artificial lights, again, economically, I have just a few lights for those 1,000 seedlings that are in a condensed area, and then as time goes on, I use more light as I repot them into larger pots. But the bottom line is they do need the artificial light. By March, then we're getting enough light from the sky that going outside does work. Actually, February, usually there's enough light. Don't quote me on this. Of course, I'm recording this, but I heard something to the effect that in Missoula, with its cloudy, overcast weather, and true, Arlie's not quite so cloudy and overcast usually, but there's usually only 5% of the light in late December in Missoula as there is in July. So that's a huge contrast, and it gives one an idea of why it's so crucial to use lights to start the seedlings. And then as time goes on by March, then they don't need the lights. They're under plastic. They're able to get what they need from the sky.
I could see that. Well, and also I think a big part of that is just that amount of daylight. You know, June 22nd, right, is the longest day of the year. So July, just the number of actual hours the sun is up is going to be almost twice what it is in December. So that could be a little piece of it,
right,
too. But yeah,
well,
and when we used to run solar panels, when we used to run solar panels, like there were only 3 weeks in December that we kind of had to use our backup generator. But usually the rest of the year was pretty good. But yeah, there's those 3 weeks in December that are pretty tough. And I know Missoula's got that inversion cloudy piece that we don't have to deal with.
Precisely. Yeah.
That could have something to do with it, too,
yeah,
I suppose.
Exactly.
Awesome. Oh,
yeah,
David,
the thing
you
is
are...
that,
go ahead.
Oh, yeah. So it's like, you know, you talked about the cloudiness. June is usually a cloudier month. I think that they were saying that July has the highest sunshine factor in Missoula because it's somewhat less cloudy than June, even though you're right that June 22nd does have the highest sun angle and the longest hours. But for our climate and our location, you have to kind of push it. I'm sure for Eureka too, push it into July, and that's when you get your maximum amount of photons.
Mm-hmm. I believe it. You know, I was going to ask you something about, because my husband talks a lot about like the difference between, he'll start our plants when he starts the seedlings. He usually starts his about February. So that might be a tip for him to kind of start those tomatoes sooner. And he starts them in the house in the south window. But then what he does is he plastics off our porch off of our kitchen. And then we just leave the kitchen door open and the kitchen window open. And the heat from the house goes into that area that he puts like a double plastic space up. And that's kind of what we use for a greenhouse. But that is on the north side of our house. And he talks a lot about like the, you know, the difference between growing on the north and the south side. And I always think you want your plants on the south side, but I don't really think you do, right? Maybe, you know,
well,
in the middle of summer when you really want them to grow. But something makes me think he's told me in the beginning, the north side has the right kind of light anyway.
Mm-hmm. Well, if you're growing in winter time, the north side is going to be in shade. Mm-hmm. There's just not going to be much light because the sun angle is so low, your house is shading your north side. Mm-hmm. And the sun rises not straight east or west in December. Mm-hmm. It's rising in the southeast and then setting in the southwest. So the north part of your house never sees any sunshine. Mm-hmm. But if your porch is kind of away, and especially if it has, let's say, a fiberglass ceiling, something like that, to where the light can actually get in, it might be adequate. Your porch might also be a little cooler. And so if there's not enough light, the seedlings should be grown a little bit cooler anyway, and that can produce some good seedlings, it's true. Mm-hmm. But the key is direct sunlight is so important, and failing that than having the artificial lights. I might add that this plant shed I spoke about that's 12 foot by 16 has no windows because that would just be a source of heat loss. It's 6-inch walls, well-insulated and well-litted with fiberglass or whatever insulation they use for the ceiling. So it's a very well insulated place. I also keep my cats there at night, so they provide the carbon dioxide, and it's a nice warm place for cats and nice for the plants. And that way I minimize the use of energy because those lights do produce some energy. They're the efficient grow light fluorescent lights, but they do produce enough energy where everybody and everything is warm, and I watch the temperature. I do have to have a fan. We have Chinook weather where it's in the 50s or 60s. It actually gets too warm in there, so I have to exhaust it. So I watch the temperature, maximize the light, and that's what I recommend to everybody is to watch the light. For a few plants, you can get grow outfits from like Ace Hardware. A lot of these places have nice little grow kits where you can grow a nice couple dozen tomato plants, at least start them off with plenty of light, and you're much healthier, happier seedlings.
Fantastic. All right. I just think listeners have learned so much already. I know I have. And I think people are probably getting excited to plant some stuff this winter. All right. Well, so let's see. We did kind of already talk about some things that were that you're. Is there something specific you're going to do different next year, or did we kind of cover that already?
Well, I think that one thing we missed when I said I started the plants in December is that I graft the tomatoes.
Oh, really?
And that's what I did. 1,000 tomatoes is grafts. That's why I start them extra early. I'd say, unless you have a hoop house and you're ready to start heating it in March, starting plants in December is way too early. But the grafting process knocks some of the speed out of your seedlings. In the long term, it's a fantastic process. It does wonders for producing healthier tomatoes a much longer period. The people that I grew for, they have hoop houses and a little more sophisticated than mine, so they start planting them out in February. But the reason they like my grafted plants is that the rootstock is actually a hybrid between a normal tomato and a wild tomato relative from South America. And by themselves, they don't produce any edible fruit, but if you graft a good variety of tomato on top, then this rootstock gives them this tremendous vigor, and they'll stay in production longer. It's interesting that the hydroponic people often use grafted plants. Now, they control their conditions perfectly. There's like no disease issues. The temperature is perfect. They, you know, have those roots swished in that solution all the time. But they graft because it gives a longer productivity. The vines will last months longer, even under those perfect conditions. And for less than perfect conditions, like how I grow and how these other people at St. Ignatius grow, we grow actually in soil. We are certain that it produces a more tasty, probably more nutritious tomato. That the grafting does wonders. It can take the cold soil better. It doesn't need as much fertilizer. It just so invigorates the plant that even though it can't pass on its disease resistance directly, a much more vigorous vine resists diseases. And the whole point is the productivity, the longevity of productivity, and the general robustness and disease resistance of the plants is substantially enhanced by the grafting. A bit tedious. It's a process. I'm learning it and getting pretty good at it now, but it does really pay off. I charge these people about $1 a plant, but they probably get at least, oh, who knows, $20 more in production per plant by grafting than they would otherwise. So it more than pays for it for them.
Awesome. Yep. I asked her, I was like, you're heating a hoop house with a wood stove and still, you know, you can make money selling the tomatoes. And she's like, oh yeah.
yeah. But for next year, then I'm going to branch out. I'm trying to locate adequate rootstock for grafting besides tomatoes, eggplants and peppers. And I've been doing lots of research. There is a source out of Vietnam that I don't know about if I really want to get seed from there and give them my credit card and so forth. But the whole point is that eventually I hope it becomes more available to the gardener off in the wilds of Montana like me, that I can get rootstock specifically for peppers and for eggplants as well. And the whole point is that next year I do plan on expanding into greenhouse peppers and greenhouse eggplants. They're different varieties than what one normally grows out in the garden. And so that's something new for next year. I'm going to see how can I enhance the total overall season in the Missoula area for vegetables. It would be my ideal that from May 1st on through to the end of October, that people can go to the Missoula markets, by extension any market in Montana, and get fresh tomatoes, fresh eggplants, fresh peppers, fresh cucumbers, fresh everything, locally grown, grown in soil, grown organically for the whole 6 months of the market season. And then we now have the winter market in Missoula, and how much can we grow? How far can we push the limits, in other words, and grow things economically, abundantly, and safely, and with greater health for this area? And I think that's important for all of Montana.
And everywhere, like, people are going to learn from this everywhere. And just, this is why I always tell people, podcasters are changing the world. You're changing the world right now today, David. You're sharing your knowledge. You're reaching out to people and teaching so much information. And I love it. Thank you so much. All right. How about something you find that's easy to grow and generally successful every time? Anything?
Well, let's see. As far as something kind of different, but I just take so much pleasure every single day, is that I grow rhododendrons, which aren't considered a true Montana crop. Western Montana, you can put them in the proper places. And there's even rumor that somewhere in Missoula, there's a 14-foot rhododendron. Somebody has one of those. And I don't know where, and the nursery is being secretive about it, but those things do grow if you do them right. They're generally considered south or coastal, but the right varieties, they grow. And the neat thing is they have big fat leaves that stay on all year. And then they have this unbelievable display of flowers in the spring. So getting away from vegetables, just having something that every single day I can look out my window and see these beautiful, fully leafed green plants that resist the season. The ones I grow take 25 below zero and come out unscathed, and they just are wonderful. So that's the one thing I really find pleasurable. I have to prepare well the soil when I initially plant, but after that, it's like they just only want some nice, steady summer water, and that's it. And then they're just a constant source of real pleasure and joy. So near my entrance, where I look out my windows, I make sure I have rhododendrons. But getting back to the food issue, I would say peppers. I've really come to like the hot peppers. I grow quite a few container hot peppers. I sell a lot of those at the market. They're beautiful as well as ornamental. Actually, as well as edible, ornamental and edible. And they are really a fun crop to grow. And they have been my standby that I've probably been doing consistently for approaching 25 years. I've tried this crop and that crop and experimented and had fun. And when everybody else starts growing them, then I move on to something else. But the peppers are one thing I just kept growing and bringing to the market for over a couple decades now.
Cool. And you said you sell the pepper plants in containers, right? Is what you meant?
Yeah. What so I people encourage can have people a plant? To do is for hot. Yes, the hot peppers just don't quite like our cool nights and our cool soil. But if you grow them in a pot, and unless you're just an absolute self-immolating chili head, you need just hundreds of these every week to consume. All you need is a couple hot pepper plants to generally keep your food spiced up throughout the whole year, and grow them in containers, and I grow them for you, and you just buy them from me, and they'll do very well. You can bring them in before the frosts and put them in a sunny window or under lights and keep the pepper plant going, or at least just harvest what you have and let it go. But it's just, they just add so much to the food, and they're different flavors, and they're a beautiful ornamental plant, as I said. And that way you can have a very nice crop right here in Montana. If you like habaneros, that's the way to grow them. If you put them out in the garden, they just don't do as well here. But in the pots, they do wonderfully.
Awesome. How about something you would steer new gardeners away from that you find is typically challenging to grow in your climate?
Steer people away from? You know, you gave me some of these questions before, and that was one that I just, to this point, don't really have an answer. Maybe we have to get outlandish and safe. Oh, melons are.
You might be down in the melon area. I just saw the Dixon melon people last night at the Columbia Falls Farmers Market.
Yeah. No, I'm 3,100 feet, and they're down like 2,700 feet, so they have some climatic advantages. But I have to tell you a funny story, is that back in, I'm trying to think of the year, around 1989, I brought watermelons to the market. It's like the first time I started coming to the market. They didn't know me. They saw these watermelons, and it was quite surprising. From the early 70s until that point, nobody had brought watermelons to the Missoula Farmers Market. The assumption was you just can't grow these things here. Wrong. So I was growing these watermelons, and I brought them, and boy, did that create some questions. Because to maintain the standards, they want to make sure these things are locally grown, and if something is suspicious, they do check it out. Well, they checked me out and saw that I really did have watermelons, and I just enjoyed growing those for several years. Well, since then, we have so many great watermelon growers and other melons at Dixon and down at Paradise, and I just don't even bother. I just buy them from the growers at the market. It's something I could grow again, but they do have a bit of a climate advantage. But I did grow them at Arley at 3,100 feet, and I started the plants. I used black plastic mulch. I babied them, and I got a crop, and I sold it at the market and created a bit of a stir. It was just shortly after that that Harley Hedick down at Dixon started growing melons, and then further you had Ted Seaman down at Paradise. Now we have lots of truckloads of melons coming into the market. So I have to laugh. What was considered impossible from the time the market started for a good decade, nobody had melons. Now I bring a few and create a little bit of a stir, and now we have them by the truckloads, local, nice, organically grown melons filling the markets and the stores. It's just a lesson there that we can really grow all kinds of things. I guess what I guess that is a lesson that whatever you'd be inclined to grow, try growing it. Now, if we get really outlandish, yes, citrus and coconuts just do not do well here. You'd be spending vast, vast amounts of fossil fuels and creating all sorts of energy crimes by trying to grow them here. But otherwise, things like melons, peppers, eggplants, things that people assumed you could never grow here, oh, they grow just fine. You just have to figure out a way to do it.
Cool. I was going to say something. All right. Well, I'll probably think of it in a little bit. At the farmer's market, you are right. They had that, the Dixon Melon people had this truckload bed full of melons, and you could smell it just walking, like, you know, 10 feet away. You could smell the aroma of these fresh, delicious melons. And I think I forgot what it's like to get food from a farmer's market, because it's been so long since I've really been to one. I've been trying to get to the Missoula farmer's market for like 4 summers now. And that day I saw you was the first time I have made it down there. I mean, it's just getting to Missoula for me in the summer has been a bit of an obstacle. And anyway, yep. But so I've had trying to go find some guests to be on my show. I went to the Kalispell Farmers Market 2 weeks ago and got some fresh cauliflower that just melted in my mouth, and these squashes that I took, like, they just, I ate the skin and all. They were so tender. And then I brought a squash home last night, and Mike just looked at me. He's like, your refrigerator is full of squash. What are you doing? But it was like one of those patty pan ones that we didn't grow. I don't know what I was thinking. Couldn't resist. You just look at that stuff and your mouth starts to water. I do anyway. I'm a vegetable.
Yes.
Like,
that's,
I think,
true.
I'm part rabbit or something. All right, David, is there an activity that you don't really like to do? What's your least favorite activity to do in the garden? Anything you got to force yourself to get out there and do?
Well, something I really don't like to do is having to spray aphids in a hopeless manner when they're doing in my tomatoes. That's a recent activity that I don't like. But otherwise, I tend to procrastinate on the weeding, you know, and then of course they get big and then I have a bigger job, but so weeding is one thing I'm not too fond of, but it's got to be done. And the thing is you see such good results, a nice cleaned up bed where everything looks just beautiful is the reward. So I suppose that my general advice is if there's something you particularly don't like, tackle it first, just get it done, and then you'll be surprisingly happy that you did it. And we'll see very good results. I think sometimes people just want to put off things they don't like, and they don't really want to push it. But push it, and you'll be rewarded.
Swallow that frog. There's a book by a guy named Brian Tracy about swallowing that frog, doing the thing that scares you the most or your biggest challenge. Get it over with first thing in the morning, and then the rest of your day will feel better. So on the flip side, what's your favorite activity to do in the garden?
My favorite activity?
Mm-hmm.
I just having a nice cup of coffee and wandering around looking at it. Just seeing things growing and noticing little things and just being out there happy. And it's a nice spiritual meditative estate just to go out there and revel in the life and the surging life that you see around you. It's important to do that because it then provides you the fuel and the energy to keep plotting, to keep planning, to keep doing, to keep swallowing that frog.
Me too. Tell us about the best gardening advice you have ever received.
The best garden advice I ever received was from a Chinese booklet, How to Grow Vegetables the Chinese Way. And it had several Chinese proverbs throughout, and one was that said, if the people work hard, the land won't be lazy. And I thought, it kind of ties in with that, you know, swallow that frog or, you know, do things that are hard, just get them done. But it's something that the Chinese had created as a proverb, who knows how many centuries ago. They're such an amazing people. But I just remembered that, and it just stuck with me. It's like, you know, when I get down and I'm just thinking, ugh, I want to get out there. And it's like, you know, if the people work hard, the land won't be lazy.
Awesome. How about your favorite tool? What if you had to move and could only take one tool with you, what could you not live without?
Well, as far as garden tools, probably a drip irrigation system.
Oh, my husband is just whining about, I got to find a way to irrigate. I got to find a way to irrigate.
Yeah, no, those are just wonderful. I strongly recommend them. Seems like every hardware store and every big building store has them now. And I strongly recommend people go ahead and figure them out, play with them. They can be kind of fun to play with. And then they can get really out of hand. You can get the little mister systems and even have your potted plants all hooked up with little hoses and everything. Get little timers. Like I say, you can get out of hand, but you should probably keep it simple at first. Just start playing with it, and then let it charm you, let it seduce you, let it make sure that it becomes an indispensable tool for you. I really recommend gardeners get the drip lines, the various little automated systems. They're just wonderful.
Okay, we got to go a little bit deeper here. So, what would be like if you were a very first going to the store, knew nothing about it? Like, what would be the first things essentials that you would look for? Like, I have no idea.
Well,
like,
is there that
drip hose or PVC pipe or something? Or,
well, I would say that the drip line. They do offer kits, you know. So I say this will cover so many square feet of your garden. I have found the weeping hose. It's supposed to be the semi-porous hose. Don't work. But the little inline drippers, they have these hoses that have the little emitters, and they drip out a certain amount, kind of steady up and down the line. They sort of regulate their own pressure, and they're just wonderful. My hoop house is, that's the only way to water. You have to remember, hoop house totally stops any natural precipitation from falling in. So you have to have some system, and the drip lines just are wonderful. So on hot days, you can turn it on every day for maybe 15 minutes, and you keep your soil moisture just perfect, just right. And the plants never know drought. They never know being drowned. They don't have that huge swing that the traditional sprinkling systems do, that where they're just inundated and then they dry out. But with these little drippers, and you put the water right where it's needed. The people who developed it were the Israelis. It's initially an Israeli technology, but the whole world is using them now. But the Israelis had very little water in a very dry country, but nevertheless, good enough soils and a potential that they could have a large agricultural system. But that limitation of water was such a huge factor. So this is the brilliant ideas that they came up with some decades ago, and since then it's been developed further all over the world. In California, they use drip lines extensively, and I can guarantee you that California will be using drip lines even more extensively, considering their current dire strait of water abundance. So, but here, okay, so let's say we have lots of water, but still the thing is that you put just a little bit in the soil as needed. You're not washing out your fertilizers. And our water is cold. Almost any kind of source of water you have here, it's cold water. Irrigation water comes from melting glaciers here. And the well water reflects the average annual temperature. It's 47 degrees at Arleigh. But these little drip lines, they put just a little bit of water so that you never really chill your soil. And that's extremely helpful for melons, for tomatoes, for peppers, for eggplants, anything that likes the warmth.
Oh, my goodness. Okay. Lots of great information there. Gosh, I just feel like I learned a ton right there. How about Do you have any preserving secrets? Do you do any canning or drying of vegetables or anything?
I don't really. What I like to do is freeze. Freezing is very convenient, and I make a point to freeze what I will eat. You know, in other words, I remember my poor mom who once had six kids, and then she didn't have six kids, and she still couldn't help overbuying and over-freezing and over-canning, and then years later the stuff had to be tossed out. So I just usually have enough to where I get through the winter, and I focus then on my limited freezer space, huckleberries, blueberries, peaches, all locally grown, by the way, and I just do that. The freezing of fruits is easy because they don't need the blanching that the vegetables do, but I do love a nice stash of frozen string beans or frozen peas, and those do require blanching, but that's a simple process. And then they can be frozen, but eat them up that winter. Make sure that you have a bare freezer by May so that you're eager for the fresh stuff again.
Ooh, I like that. I am lucky if I can, I don't know about this year. We kind of just changed our system, so we have a big garden this year for the first time ever, like huge. It's like a mini farm, I tell Mike, because we dug a well. So we finally have water. But usually I'm lucky if I still have stuff in my freezer by March. I'm lucky if I still have it at Christmas. How about, do you have any special techniques for cooking any kind of weird or unusual foods, or weird techniques for cooking ordinary foods, or any kind of cooking techniques, things?
Not really. I like to cook fast. And in other words, if it's going to be cooked, you know, to apply the minimal amount of heat, you know, for preservation of flavor. So I do stir fry quite a bit. And I do like broths. I like the what they call those, the Spanish style chicken broth that I make quite a large batch of that periodically, and I'll use it throughout the week, keep it refrigerated, of course. And then that way, then everything else can be cooked fast. You know, and the broth maybe has been simmered over a long time, and you know, you're maybe ruining all the vitamins, but hey, it tastes good. And then you use it for things that you do cook fresh, where you do preserve the vitamins, and that lovely combination of savory, long-stewed, good flavors with fresh, sprightly, just cooked flavors. That's the way to go.
All right. How about a favorite recipe you like to cook from the garden? Would that just be stir-fry, or you got
Well,
some-
one of them is... Well, one is a Sichuan style eggplant. A lot of people who have just a dismal view of eggplants because they probably had it only fixed one way and that way badly. But this is where it's a neat trick because eggplant absorbs huge amounts of oil. It's just people find that a difficult thing because when you fry it or you try to do anything with oil, it just sucks it right up, and you're ruining all the health benefits of the eggplant by the fact that you've got a pound of butter in each eggplant. But the way that this recipe works is that you cube the eggplant, but you stir fry it in a wok, but not oil, but with chicken broth. Oh. So that steams it and cooks it just right. And then later on, when you add the other ingredients, add just a little bit of oil. And that way you get kind of a less oil, but delicious. The other ingredients are freshly pork ground, and then also chili pepper, and ginger, oyster sauce, the usual oriental seasonings. And that way you can have a delicious eggplant dish without much fat. And it's spicy. I like the spicy part. People can tone that down if they wish. And it's a fast, easy, wonderful way to prepare eggplant.
Okay. I'm just going to say really quickly, one of my secrets, because I think people have been telling me they're surprised that I love eggplant so much. To me, one of the secrets is I pick them when they're smaller. I don't wait till they get big like the normal eggplants you see in the store. I'll pick them when they're, you know, not a, I don't know what, 8, 10 inches, not even 6, 8 inches, and just like a fist in diameter. I'm holding my fist up and nobody can see it, of course, but just, you know, not
of course.
Probably like what, 2 inches in diameter, you know, just not as big as you would expect. Yeah. And I think that's one of the secrets to making eggplant taste good. Do you agree? Do you like them smaller, or do you like the big ones?
Oh, they have to be smaller. A lot of people don't understand that the grocery stores, I think that the Californians that grow the eggplants for our markets are laughing their heads off because they choose the biggest, most worthless bitter, awful eggplants, and they ship off to Montana expecting us to be too stupid to know any different. But
they're like that everywhere.
They have to be smaller. They have to be glossy. They have to be a real shiny, glossy color. When they start getting dull, they're getting older, and that's when they're often bitter. It's the most common mm-hmm. thing to say, "Ugh, I hate eggplant. It's so bitter." It's like, well, you never had a good eggplant. But they have to be picked younger. They have to be, there's no such thing as an immature eggplant. From the time they set as little tiny buttons on the flower, they're edible. It's just that you need some size so you're not peeling forever, you know, a zillion mm-hmm. little eggplants. But they do get too big, and they start losing that gloss. They're just awful. But that's what you see in the stores. But I often sell mine smaller, and I have people complain. They'll say, well, when you finally get some size to your eggplants, I'll buy one. And I said, here, have a free one. Take this home, try it. You'll find out that you don't want them big. This is when they are really, truly delicious. And I do that. You know, I give up an eggplant that I got them hooked.
Mm-hmm. That's a great tip, too. Sampling was one of my guests, Joyce Pinson from Kentucky, talked about sampling as a major secret to being successful at a farmer's market. Yeah. David, do you do anything on the internet? Do you have a favorite internet resource for gardening at all?
Well, I'm constantly looking for information. I can't really say there's a particularly favorite source, except that Johnny Seeds out of Maine, they've mm-hmm. Been a seed source, but they're coming up with really good, succinct but well-informed grow guides. If a person wants to do things a bit different, such as growing things in a hoop house, they have some very good information. They also had some of the best information I saw on grafting tomatoes, for example. So by horrible trial and error, I'd already figured out a lot of this, but then I saw what he had written, and it was actually quite good. So save yourself a lot of trouble and just pull up the Johnny's website and get their information on grafting, on growing things in hoop houses, trellising, all these different techniques. And
all right, I'm going to have to do that. And, we've actually had a lot of conversations about quite a few of those topics.
Yeah.
Mike's been talking to me about, I was just asking him about how to grow a trellis, and then he was talking to me about grafting. Was it fruit or I don't know. I brought home some apricots and was like, here, try these apricot seeds. And he's like, I think you have to graft those. I don't think you can grow from a seed anymore. How about a favorite reading material? Got a favorite book or a magazine or anything that you love?
I'd have to go back to say that it was from the Sunset Gardening mm-hmm. source, but it's the, Chinese, growing gardens, Chinese style. I can't remember the title of the thing. I bought it way back a long time ago, and it's just in tatters now. I probably have it somewhere, but it was quite good. It helped me understand how to grow things in beds instead of just straight rows like a field. And it did a lot along with the Rodale publications. That publication was instrumental in creating a much more satisfying gardening experience for me.
Mm-hmm. Excellent. It reminds me, my husband's canning book is from Sunset, and it's tattered, too. Okay, ready for my final question?
Okay.
It's kind of a doozy. If there's one change you would like to see, David, to create a greener world, what would it be? For example, is there a charity or organization you're passionate about or a project you'd like to see put into action? Like, what do you feel is the most crucial issue facing our planet in regards to the environment, either locally, nationally, or on a global scale?
No, I look at that question, and it is so huge. We're talking about involving human nature and politics and power plays and the economy, and I think it's almost an unanswerable question. I would just say for myself, it was explained throughout, trying to grow things as economically but as effectively as possible. Expand that nationally. You look at some countries that they take better care of their people. The health is better. They have stronger economies. They have better health care. And then there are countries that shade away from that, to where living conditions are pretty gruesome. Well, obviously, things can be done better. They can be done worse. But it's always a work in progress. And I would just like to see that people individually take the initiative to improve their own household, to improve their own yard, to start as the center of their own improvement and just work it outward and learn all you can and look at the universe in the bigger picture. Don't be so tied to a political view or to an ideology. I think that's deadly and that's fatal to human innovation, and that people have different ideas, listen to them. If people have offensive different ideas, try to understand them as best you can. There are limits to all this, granted. But the point is that I feel that too many people get constricted. I got rid of my TV. That's one thing. It's such a time-consuming and wasteful thing that I have not had TV for years in my house, and I was minimizing it before because it overwhelms, it takes over. And so I'm not telling everybody they need to get rid of their TVs, but just to make sure they have enough time and space to meditate, to ponder, to look at different things, to look at different how different people view. And oh, if you can travel, that's so crucial too. Not just travel from resort to resort, but find out how the people live. If you can learn a foreign language, fine. If you can't, travel anyway. Learn all you can. And that will be just one person making the world better in their own best way.
All right. Awesome. I think that's a great answer. And I think actually you actually hit on quite a few things earlier as we talked about, being conscious about your environmental footprint when you're growing things and being efficient that way. One thing I have to say about TV for sure, I just feel like having Link TV and Free Speech TV and listening to Democracy, getting to we watch Democracy Now. I know there's other ways to consume it, and the Tom Hartman show, and just there's so many things I feel like we do get from TV. I mean, we would not have a satellite dish if that wasn't the only way we could get Link TV. I don't know if you know that, but it's their thing is like World Without Borders, and they just have tons of great, to me, it's like a way to communicate almost like Facebook, except it's one way, but we learned so much from, I could never live without my Link TV. What was the other thing I was going to say that you talked about? Oh, one thing that you talked about being open-minded to other people's ideas. And then I have to say some of my best things have come from my opposition. Like some of my best, like I wrote a book about Jeanette Rankin, and I would have never wrote that book about Jeanette Rankin if one of my professors at U of M hadn't called her a flake. And so after he did that, I went looking for a book and couldn't find one. And then of course, when I wrote mine, so did like seven other people, and they were all published at the same time. And just, I don't know. But anyway, I think embracing your opposition sometimes will lead you to those breakthroughs. All right, David, do you have an inspirational tip or quote to help motivate listeners to reach into the dirt and start their own garden?
We'll go back to the Chinese proverb. If the people work hard, the land won't be lazy.
All right. That is a great way to finish this interview. We'll just tell everybody to come to the Missoula Farmers Market and just talk to you in person, because that's a total experience worth it in itself. If you've never been to Missoula, Montana, you can't go wrong. If you come to the Farmers Market on Saturday morning, it sounds like David will be there and you can meet him in person and you won't go wrong.
I will be there.
How's that sound?
That's right.
Okay. Absolutely. Thank you so much, David, for sharing your expertise with everybody today.
Thank you for listening to the Organic Gardener Podcast. I'd like to encourage you to visit our website at awesomemontana.com. That's just AWESOMEMONTANA.com, like awesome Montana, all spelled out. And click on Mike's Green Garden and the Organic Gardener Podcast, and it will link right to the show notes and all the things we've talked about on today's show. Thanks again for listening, and grow local.